Chapter 6. What Varvara Ardalionovna had told her brother about the evening party at the Epanchins, at which Princess Bielokonski was expected, was also quite correct. The guests were expected that evening. But in this case, too, she'd expressed herself rather too strongly. It had, indeed, all been arranged with too much hurry, and even with some quite unnecessary excitement, just because in that family they never could do things like other people. It was all due to the impatience of Lizaveta Prokofievna, who was anxious not to be kept longer in suspense, and to the feverish tremors of both parental hearts concerning the happiness of their favourite daughter. Moreover, Princess Bielokonski really was going away soon, and as her patronage certainly did carry weight in society, and as they hoped she would be well disposed to Mushkin, the parents reckoned that the world would accept Aglaya's betrothed straight from the hands of the omnipotent old princess, and that therefore, if there were anything strange about it, it would seem much less strange under such patronage. The real fact was that the parents were quite unable to settle the question themselves, whether there was anything strange in the matter, and if so, how much, or whether there was nothing strange about it at all. The candid and friendly opinion of influential and competent persons would be of use just at the present moment when, thanks to Aglaya, nothing had been finally settled. In any case, sooner or later the prince would have to be introduced into society, of which he had so far not the faintest idea. In short, they were intending to show him. The party arranged was, however, a simple one. Only friends of the family were expected, and not many of them. One other lady besides Princess Bielokonski was coming, the wife of a very important dignitary. Yevgeny Pavlovich was almost the only young man expected, and he was to escort Princess Bielokonski. Mushkin heard that Princess Bielokonski was coming 3 days beforehand. Of the party, he learned only the previous day. He noticed, of course, the busy air of the members of the family, and even from certain insinuating and anxious attempts to broach the subject to him, he perceived that they dreaded the impression he might make. But somehow the Epanchins, all without exception, were possessed by the idea that he was too simple to be capable of guessing that they were uneasy in this way on his account. And so, looking at him, everyone was inwardly troubled. He did, in fact, however, attach scarcely any consequence to the approaching event. He was occupied with something quite different. Aglaya was becoming every hour more gloomy and capricious. That was crushing him. When he knew that they were expecting Yevgeny Pavlovich, he was greatly delighted, and said that he had long been wishing to see him. For some reason, no one liked these words. Aglaya went out of the room in vexation, and only late at night, about 12 o'clock, when Mushkin was going away, she seized an opportunity of a few words alone with him, as she saw him out.
"I should like you not to come and see us all day tomorrow, but to come in the evening when these visitors are here. You know that there are to be visitors?"
She spoke impatiently and with intense severity. It was the first time she had spoken to him of this party. To her, too, the idea of these visitors was almost insufferable. Everyone noticed it. She may have felt greatly tempted to quarrel with her parents about it, but pride and modesty kept her from speaking. Mushkin saw at once that she also was afraid on his account, and did not want to admit that she was afraid, and he too felt suddenly frightened.
"Yes, I have been invited," he answered.
She evidently found it difficult to go on.
"Can one speak to you about anything serious just for once?"
She grew suddenly fearfully angry, not knowing why, and not able to control herself.
"You can, and I am listening."
"I'm very glad," muttered Mushkin. Aglaya paused again for a minute, and began with evident repugnance.
"I didn't want to dispute with them about it, for you can't make them see reason about some things. Some of Maman's principles have always been revolting to me. I say nothing about Papa. It's no use expecting anything from him. Maman is a noble woman, of course. If you dared to propose anything mean to her, you'd see. Yet she bows down before these contemptible creatures. I don't mean the old princess. She's a contemptible old woman, contemptible in character, but clever, and knows how to turn them all round her finger. One can say that for her, anyway. Oh, the meanness of it. And it's ludicrous. We've always been people of the middle class, as middle class as could possibly be. Why force ourselves into this aristocratic circle? And my sisters are on the same tack. Prince S. has upset them all. Why are you pleased that Yevgeny Pavlovich will be here?
Listen, Aglaya, said Mushkin. It seems to me that you are very much afraid that I should be flawed tomorrow in this company.
Me? Afraid on your account?
Aglaya flushed all over.
Why should I be afraid on your account? Even if you do disgrace yourself utterly, what is it to me? And how can you use such words? What do you mean by being flawed? It's a contemptible word, vulgar.
It's a schoolboy word.
Quite so. A schoolboy word. Contemptible. You seem to intend to use words like that all the evening tomorrow. You can look up more of them at home in your dictionary. You'll make a sensation. It's a pity that you know how to come into the room properly. Where did you learn it? Do you know how to take a cup of tea and drink it properly when everyone's looking at you on purpose?
I believe I do.
I'm sorry you do. It would have made me laugh if you didn't. Mind you, break the Chinese vase in the drawing room anyway. It was an expensive one. Please do break it. It was a present. Mother would be beside herself and would cry before everyone. She's so fond of it. Gesticulate, as you always do. Knock it over and break it. Sit near it on purpose.
On the contrary, I'll sit as far from it as I can. Thank you for warning me.
Then you are afraid you will wave your arms about? I'll bet anything you'll begin talking on some serious, learned, lofty subject. That will be tactful.
I think that would be stupid, if it's not appropriate.
Listen, once for all, said Aglaya, losing all patience. If you talk about anything like capital punishment, or the economic position of Russia, or how beauty will save the world, of course I should be delighted and laugh at it, but I warn you, never show yourself before me again. Do you hear? I'm in earnest. This time I'm in earnest.
She really was in earnest in her threat. Something exceptional could be heard in her words and seen in her eyes, which Mushkin had never noticed before, and which was not like a joke. Now, after what you've said, I'm sure to talk too much, even perhaps break the vase. I wasn't in the least afraid before, and now I'm afraid of everything. I shall certainly be flawed.
Then hold your tongue. Sit quiet and hold your tongue.
I shan't be able to. I'm sure I shall be so alarmed that I shall begin talking and shall break the vase. Perhaps I shall fall down on the slippery floor, or something of that sort. But that has happened to me before. I shall dream about it all night. Why did you talk to me about it? Aglaya looked gloomily at him. I tell you what, I'd better not come at all tomorrow. I'll report myself ill, and that will be the end of it, he concluded at last. Aglaya stamped and turned positively white with anger.
Good God! Did anyone ever see anything like it? He's not coming, when it has all been arranged on purpose for him, and, my goodness, it's a treat to have to do with a senseless person like you. I'll come, Mushkin broke in hastily, and I give you my word of honour that I'll sit the whole evening without opening my mouth. I'll manage it. You'll do well. You said just now you'd report yourself ill. Where do you pick up such expressions? What possesses you to talk to me in such language? Are you trying to tease me?
I beg your pardon. That's a schoolboy expression, too. I won't use it. I quite understand that you are anxious on my account.
Yes, don't be angry.
And I'm awfully glad of it. You don't know how frightened I am now, and how glad I am of your words. But I assure you, all this panic is petty and nonsensical. It really is a glare. But the joy remains. I'm awfully glad that you're such a child. Such a kind, good child. Oh, how splendid you can be, Aglaya. Aglaya, of course, was on the point of flying into a rage, but suddenly a rush of quite unexpected feeling took possession of her soul in one instant.
And you won't reproach me for my coarse words just now? Some day?
Afterwards? She asked suddenly.
How can you? How can you?
Why, are you flaring up again? And now you're looking gloomy again. You've taken to looking too gloomy sometimes now, Aglaya, as you never used to look.
I know why that is. Hush, hush.
No, it's better to speak. I've been wanting to say it a long time. I've said it already, but that's not enough, for you didn't believe me. There's one person who stands between us.
Hush, 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 hush,
Aglaya interrupted suddenly, gripping his hand tightly and looking at him almost in terror. At that moment her name was called. With an air of relief, she left him at once and ran away. Mushkin was in a fever all night. Strange to say, he had been feverish for several nights running. That night, when he was half delirious, the thought occurred to him, what if he should have a fit tomorrow before everyone? He had had fits in public. He turned cold at the thought. All night he imagined himself in a mysterious and incredible company among strange people. The worst of it was that he kept talking. He knew he ought not to talk, but he went on talking all the time. He was trying to persuade them of something. Yevgeny Pavlovich and Ippolit were of the party, and seemed extremely friendly. He waked up at 9 o'clock with a headache, with confusion in his mind and strange impressions. He felt an intense and unaccountable desire to see Rogozhin, to see him and to say a great deal to him. What about, he could not himself have said. Then he fully made up his mind to go and see Ippolit. There was some confused sensation in his heart, so much so that, although he felt acutely what happened to him that morning, he could not fully realize it. One thing that happened to him was a visit from Lebedev. Lebedev made his appearance rather early, soon after 9, and was almost completely drunk. Although Mushkin had not been observant of late, yet he could not help seeing that ever since General Ivolgin had left them, that is, for the last 3 days, Lebedev had been behaving very badly. He seemed to have suddenly become extremely greasy and dirty. His cravat was on one side, and the collar of his coat was torn. In his lodge he kept up a continual storm, which was audible across the little courtyard. Vera had come in on one occasion in tears to tell him about it. On presenting himself that morning, he talked very strangely, beating himself on the breast and blaming himself for something.
"I have received the chastisement for my baseness and treachery. A slap in the face,"
he concluded tragically at last.
"A slap in the face? From whom? And so early?"
"So early!"
And Lebedev smiled sarcastically.
"The time has nothing to do with it, even for physical chastisement. But I've received a moral, not a physical castigation."
He suddenly sat down without ceremony and began to tell his story. It was a very incoherent one. Mushkin frowned and wanted to get away, but all at once some words caught his attention. He was struck dumb with amazement. Mr. Lebedev was telling of strange things. He had apparently begun about some letter. Aglaya Ivanovna's name was mentioned. Then Lebedev began all at once bitterly reproaching Mushkin himself. It could be gathered that he was offended with the prince. At first, he said, the prince had honoured him with his confidence in transactions with a certain person, with Nastasia Philipovna, but had afterwards broken with him completely, and had dismissed him with ignominy, and had even been so offensive as to repel with rudeness an innocent question about the approaching changes in the house. With drunken tears, Lebedev protested that after that he could endure no more, especially as he knew a great deal, a very great deal, from Rogozhin, from Nastasia Philipovna, and from her friend, and from Varvara Ardalionovna herself, and from even Aglaya Ivanovna.
"Would you believe it? Through Vera, through my beloved, my only daughter, yes. Though indeed she's not my only one, for I've 3. And who was it informed Lizaveta Prokofievna by letters? In dead secret, of course. Who has been writing to her about all the shiftings and changings of the personage Nastasia Philipovna? Who? Who is the anonymous writer, allow me to ask?
Can it be you?" cried Mushkin.
"Just so," the drunkard replied with dignity. "And this very morning at 8:30, only 3/4 of an hour ago, I informed the noble-hearted mother that I had an incident of importance to communicate to her. I informed her by letter through a maid at the back door. She received it."
"You've just seen Lizaveta Prokofievna?" cried Mushkin, unable to believe his ears.
"I saw her just now and received a blow, a moral one. She gave me back the letter. In fact, she flung it in my face unopened, and even kicked me out. Only morally speaking, not physically. Though it was almost physical, too, not far off it."
"What letter was it she flung at you unopened?"
"Why, Haven't I told you? I thought I'd said that already. It was a letter I had received on purpose to give to... From whom? From whom?
It was difficult to make head or tail of some explanations of Lebediev's, or to understand anything from them. But as far as he could make out, Mushkin gathered that the letter had been brought in the early morning to Vera Lebediev by the servant girl, to be delivered to the person to whom it was addressed.
Just as before. Just as before, to a certain personage, and from the same person, for I designate one of them a person, and the other only a personage, as derogatory and distinguishing, for there is a great distinction between an innocent and high-born young lady of a general's family, and a lady of the other sort. And so the letter was from that person, beginning with the letter A.
How could that be? To Nastasia Philipovna? Nonsense, cried Mushkin.
It was. It was. Or, if not to her, to Rogozhin. It's all the same, to Rogozhin. And there was even one to Mr. Terentyev, to be handed on from the person beginning with A,
said Lebediev, smiling and winking. As he was continually mixing one thing up with another, and forgetting what he had begun to speak about, Mushkin held his peace to let him speak out. Yet it still remained far from clear whether the correspondence had been carried on through him or through Vera, since he himself declared that it was just the same whether the letters were for Rogozhin or for Nastasia Philipovna. It seemed more likely that the letters had not passed through his hands, if there actually had been letters. How this letter had come into his hands remained absolutely inexplicable. The most probable explanation was that he had somehow snatched them from Vera, stolen them on the sly, and carried them for some object to Lizaveta Prokofievna. That was what Mushkin gathered and understood at last.
"You're out of your mind!" he cried in extreme agitation.
"Not quite, honoured prince," Lebediev replied, not without malice. "It's true. I meant to hand it to you, to put it into your own hands, to do you a service. But I reflected that it was better to be of use in that quarter by revealing everything to the noble-hearted mother, as I had communicated with her before by letter anonymously. And when I wrote to her just now, a preliminary note, asking her to see me at 8:20, I signed myself again, Your Secret Correspondent. I was admitted promptly, with the utmost haste, by the back door, to the presence of the illustrious lady.
Well?
And there, as you know already, she nearly beat me. Very nearly, so that one might almost say she practically did beat me. And she threw the letter in my face. It's true she wanted to keep it. I saw it, I noticed it. But she thought better of it and flung it in my face. Since a fellow like you has been entrusted with it, give it. She was positively offended. Since she wasn't ashamed to say so before me, she must have been offended. She's a hot-tempered lady.
Where is the letter now?
Why, I've got it still. Here it is.
And he handed Mushkin Aglaya's note to Gavril Ardalionovitch, which the latter, 2 hours later, showed to his sister with such triumph.
That letter can't remain with you.
It's for you. For you. It's to you. I am bringing it,
Lebediev hastened to declare with warmth.
Now I am yours again, entirely yours from head to heart. Your servant, after my momentary treachery. Punish the heart, spare the beard, as Thomas More said, in England and in Great Britain. Mea culpa, as the Romish Pope says. That is, I mean the Pope of Rome, though I call him the Romish Pope.
This letter must be sent off at once, said Mushkin anxiously. I'll give it.
But wouldn't it be better, most highly bred prince, to do this?
Lebediev made a strange, expressive grimace. He fidgeted violently in his place, as though he'd been suddenly pricked by a needle, and, winking slyly, made a significant gesture with his hands.
What do you mean?
Mushkin asked severely.
Wouldn't it be better to open it?
He whispered ingratiatingly, and, as it were, confidentially. Mushkin leapt up with such passion that Lebediev took to his heels, but he stopped short at the door to see whether he could hope for pardon.
"Ah, Lebediev! Is it possible to sink to such abject degradation as this?"
cried Mushkin bitterly. Lebediev's face brightened.
"I'm abject.
"Abject!" he approached at once, with tears, beating himself on the breast. "You know this is abominable.
Abominable it is. That's the word for it.
What a horrid habit it is to behave in this queer way. You are simply a spy. Why do you write anonymously and worry such a noble and kind-hearted woman? And why has not Aglaya Ivanovna a right to write to whom she pleases? Did you go to complain of it today? Did you hope to receive a reward? What induced you to tell tales?"
"A simply agreeable curiosity and the desire of a generous heart to be of use. Now I am yours again, all yours. You may hang me."
"Did you go to Lizaveta Prokofievna in the condition you're in now?" Mushkin inquired with disgust.
"No, I was fresher, more decent. It was only after my humiliation that I got into this state."
"Well, that's enough. Leave me." But he had to repeat this request several times before he could induce his visitor to go. Even after he had opened the door, he came back on tiptoe into the middle of the room and gesticulated with his hands to show how to open the letter. He did not venture to put his advice into words. Then he went out with a suave and amiable smile. All this had been extremely painful to hear. What was most evident was one striking fact, that Aglaya was in great trouble, great uncertainty, in great distress about something. "From jealousy," Mushkin whispered to himself. It was evident also that she was being worried by ill-intentioned people, and what was very strange was that she trusted them in this way. No doubt that inexperienced but hot and proud little head was hatching some special schemes, perhaps ruinous and utterly wild. Mushkin was greatly alarmed, and in his perturbation did not know what to decide upon. There was no doubt he must do something. He felt that. He looked once more at the address on the sealed letter. Oh, he had no doubt and no uneasiness on that side, for he trusted her. What made him uneasy about that letter was something different. He did not trust Gavril Ardalionovitch, and yet he was on the point of deciding to restore him the letter himself, and he even left the house with that object. But he changed his mind on the way. Almost at Titsin's door, by good fortune he met Kolya, and charged him to put the letter into his brother's hands, as though it had come straight from Aglaya Ivanovna. Kolya asked no questions and delivered it, so that Ganya had no suspicion that the letter had halted so many times upon its journey. Returning home, Mushkin asked Vera Lebedev to come to him, told her what was necessary, and set her mind at rest, for she had been all this time hunting for the letter and was in tears. She was horrified when she learned that her father had carried off the letter. Mushkin found out from her afterwards that she had more than once helped Rogozhin and Aglaya Ivanovna in secret, and it had never occurred to her that she could be injuring Mushkin in doing so. And Mushkin was at last so upset that when 2 hours later a messenger from Kolya ran in with the news of his father's illness, for the first minute the prince could not grasp what was the matter. But this event restored him by completely distracting his attention. He stayed at Nina Alexandrovna's, where the invalid, of course, had been carried, right up to the evening. He was scarcely of any use, but there are people whom one is, for some reason, glad to have about one in times of grief. Kolya was terribly distressed. He cried hysterically, but was continually being sent on errands. He ran for a doctor and hunted up three, ran to the chemist's and to the barber's. They succeeded in resuscitating the general, but he did not regain his senses. The doctors opined that the patient was in any case in danger. Varya and Nina Alexandrovna never left the sick man's side. Ganya was disconcerted and overcome, but would not go upstairs, and seemed afraid to see the invalid. He wrung his hands, and in incoherent and disconnected talk with Mushkin, he let drop the phrase, "What a calamity! And to come at such a moment!" Mushkin fancied he understood what he meant by "such a moment." Mushkin did not find Ippolit at Titsin's. Lebedev, who after the morning's explanation had slept all day without waking, ran in towards evening. Now he was almost sober, and shed genuine tears over the sick man, as though he had been his own brother. He blamed himself aloud, without explaining why, and would not leave Nina Alexandrovna, assuring her every moment that he was the cause of it, he and no one else, simply from agreeable curiosity, and that the departed, so he persisted in calling the still-living general, was positively a man of genius. He insisted with great seriousness on his genius, as though it might be of extraordinary service at that moment. Seeing his genuine tears, Nina Alexandrovna said to him at last, with a note of reproach and almost with cordiality,
"Well, God bless you. Don't cry. Come. God will forgive you."
Lebediev was so much impressed by these words and the tone of them that he was unwilling to leave her side all the evening, and all the following days, from early morning to the hour of the general's death, he spent in their house. Twice during the day a messenger came from Lizaveta Prokofievna to inquire after the invalid. When at 9 o'clock in the evening Mushkin made his appearance in the Epanchins' drawing-room, which was already full of guests, Lizaveta Prokofievna at once began questioning him sympathetically and minutely about the patient, and replied with dignity to Princess Bielokonski's inquiry, "What patient and who is Nina Alexandrovna?" Mushkin was much pleased at this. Explaining the position to Madame Epanchin, he spoke splendidly, as Aglaya's sisters said afterwards, modestly, quietly, with dignity, and without gestures or too many words. He walked in admirably, was perfectly dressed, and far from falling down on the slippery floor, as they had all been afraid the day before, evidently made a favourable impression on everyone. Sitting down and looking round, he, for his part, noticed at once that the company were not in the least like the bogies with which Aglaya had tried to frighten him, nor the nightmare figures of his last night's dreams. For the first time in his life, he saw a tiny corner of what is called by the dreadful name society. For some time past, certain projects, considerations, and inclinations had made him eager to penetrate into that enchanted circle, and so he was deeply interested by his first impression of it. This first impression was fascinating. It somehow seemed to him at once as though these people were, so to speak, born to be together, as though it were not a party, and no guests had been invited that evening to the Epanchins, that these were all their own people, and that he himself had long been their devoted friend and shared their thoughts, and was now returning to them after a brief separation. The charm of elegant manners, of simplicity, and of apparent frankness was almost magical. It could never have entered his head that all this simple frankness and nobility, wit, and refined personal dignity was perhaps only an exquisite artistic veneer. The majority of the guests, in spite of their prepossessing exterior, were rather empty-headed people, who were themselves unaware, however, that much of their superiority was mere veneer, for which they were not responsible indeed, as they had adopted it unconsciously and by inheritance. Mushkin, carried away by the charm of his first impression, had no inclination to suspect this. He saw, for instance, that this important and aged dignitary, who might have been his grandfather, ceased speaking in order to listen to an inexperienced young man like himself, and not only listened to him, but evidently valued his opinion, was so cordial, so genuinely kind to him, and yet they were strangers, meeting for the first time. Perhaps the refinement of this courtesy was what produced the most effect on Mushkin's eager sensitiveness. He was perhaps prejudiced and predisposed to favourable impression. And yet all these people, though of course they were friends of the family and of one another, were by no means such great friends, either of the family or of one another, as Mushkin took them to be, as soon as he met them and was introduced to them. There were persons of the party who would never on any account have recognised the Epanchins as their equals. There were persons who absolutely detested one another. Old Princess Bielokonski had always despised the wife of the old dignitary, while the latter, for her part, had anything but friendly feelings for Lizaveta Prokofievna. This dignitary, her husband, who for some reason had been a patron of the Epanchins from their youth up, and was the leading figure present, was a personage of such vast consequence in the eyes of Ivan Fyodorovitch that the latter was incapable of any sensation except reverence and awe in his presence,
and he would have had a genuine contempt for himself if he could for one moment have put himself on an equal footing with him, and have thought of him as less than the Olympian Jove. There were people who had not met one another for some years, and felt nothing but indifference, if not dislike for one another. Yet they greeted each other now as though they had only met yesterday, in the most friendly and intimate company. Yet the party was not a large one. Besides Princess Bielokonski and the old dignitary, who really was a person of consequence, and his wife, there was in the first place a very solid military general, a count or baron with a German name, a man of extraordinary taciturnity, with a reputation for a marvellous acquaintance with affairs of government, and almost with a reputation for learning, one of those Olympian administrators who know everything, except perhaps Russia itself. A man who once in 5 years made some extraordinarily profound remark, which inevitably became a proverb and penetrated even to the loftiest circles. One of those governing officials who usually, after an extremely, even strangely protracted term of service, die possessed of large fortunes and high honours in leading positions, though they have never performed any great exploits, and in fact have always a certain aversion for exploits. This general was next above Ivan Fyodorovich in the service, and the latter, in the zeal of his grateful heart and through a peculiar form of vanity, regarded him too as his patron. Yet the general by no means considered himself Ivan Fyodorovich's patron. He treated him with absolute coolness, and though he gladly availed himself of his numerous services, he would have replaced him by another official at once, if any consideration, even the most trivial, had called for such exchange. There was, too, an elderly and important gentleman who was supposed to be a relation of Lizaveta Prokofievna's, though this was quite untrue, a man of high rank and position, of birth and fortune. He was stout and enjoyed excellent health. He was a great talker, and had the reputation of a discontented man, though only in the most legitimate sense of the word, even a splenetic man, though even this was agreeable to him, with the tricks of the English aristocracy and with English tastes as regards roast beef, harness, footmen, and so on. He was a great friend of the dignitary, and amused him. Moreover, Lizaveta Prokofievna, for some reason, cherished the strange idea that this elderly gentleman, a somewhat frivolous person with a distinct weakness for the female sex, might suddenly take it into his head to make Alexandra happy with the offer of his hand. Below this top and most solid layer of the assembly came the younger guests, though these too were conspicuous for extremely elegant qualities. To this group belonged Prince S. and Yevgeny Pavlovich, and, moreover, the well-known and fascinating Prince N., who had seduced and fascinated female hearts all over Europe, a man of 45, though still of handsome appearance, and a wonderful storyteller, a man whose large fortune was to some extent dissipated, and who usually lived abroad. There were people, too, who made up, indeed, a third special stratum, not belonging themselves to the inner circle of society, though, like the Epanchins, they could sometimes be met in that circle. Through a certain sense of fitness, which always guided them, the Epanchins liked on the rare occasions of their giving parties to mix the highest society with persons of a rather lower grade, with select representatives of the middling kind of people. The Epanchins were praised, indeed, for doing so, and it was said of them that they understood their position and were people of tact, and they were proud of being thought so. One of the representatives of this middling sort was that evening a colonel of engineers, a serious man, a very intimate friend of Prince S., by whom he had been introduced to the Epanchins. He was silent in society, however, and wore on the big forefinger of his right hand a large and conspicuous ring, probably presented to him. There was present, too, a poet of German origin, but a Russian poet, and perfectly presentable, moreover, so that he could be introduced into good society without apprehension. He was of handsome, though for some reason repulsive, appearance. He was 38, and was irreproachably dressed. He belonged to an intensely bourgeois but intensely respectable German family. He was successful in taking advantage of every opportunity, gaining the patronage of persons in high places and retaining their favour. He had at one time made a verse translation of some important work of some important German poet, was adroit in dedicating his translations, and adroit in boasting of his friendship with a celebrated but deceased Russian poet. There's a perfect crowd of writers who love to record in print their friendship with great and deceased writers. And he had been quite recently brought to the Epanchins by the wife of the old dignitary. This lady was celebrated for her patronage of literary and learned men, and had even actually procured one or two writers a pension through powerful personages with whom she had influence. She really had influence of a sort. She was a lady of 45, and therefore a very young wife for so aged a man as her husband, who had been a beauty, and still, like many ladies of 45, had a mania for dressing far too gorgeously. She was of small intelligence, and her knowledge of literature was very dubious, but the patronage of literary men was as much a mania with her as was gorgeous array. Many books and translations had been dedicated to her. Two or three writers had, with her permission, printed letters they had written to her on subjects of the greatest importance. And all this society Mushkin took for true coin, for pure gold without alloy. All these people were, too, as though of set purpose, in the happiest frame of mind that evening, and very well pleased with themselves. They all, without exception, knew that they were doing the Epanchins a great honour by their visit. But alas, Mushkin had no suspicion of such subtleties. He did not suspect, for instance, that while the Epanchins were contemplating so important a step as the decision of their daughter's future, they would not have dared to omit exhibiting him, Prince Lvov Nikolaevich, to the old dignitary, who was the acknowledged patron of the family. Though the old dignitary, for his part, would have borne with perfect equanimity the news of the most awful calamity having befallen the Epanchins, he would certainly have been offended if the Epanchins had betrothed their daughter without his advice, and, so to speak, without his leave. Prince N., that charming, unquestionably witty and open-hearted man, was firmly persuaded that he was something like a sun that had risen that night to shine upon the Epanchins' drawing-room. He regarded them as infinitely beneath him, and it was just this open-hearted and generous notion which prompted his wonderfully charming ease and friendliness with the Epanchins. He knew very well that he would have to tell some story to delight the company, and led up to it with positive inspiration. When Mushkin heard the story afterwards, he felt that he had never heard anything like such brilliant humour and such marvellous gaiety and naivety, almost touching, on the lips of such a Don Juan as Prince N. If he had only known how old and hackneyed that story was, how it was known by heart, worn threadbare, stale, and a weariness in every drawing-room, and only at the innocent Epanchins passed for a novelty, for an impromptu, genuine and brilliant reminiscence of a splendid and brilliant man. Even the little German poet, although he behaved with great modesty and politeness, was ready to believe that he was conferring an honour on the family by his presence. But Mushkin saw nothing of the other side, noticed no undercurrent. This was a mischance that Aglaya had not foreseen. She was looking particularly handsome that evening. The three young ladies were dressed for the evening, but not over-smartly, and wore their hair in a particular style. Aglaya was sitting with Yevgeny Pavlovich, and was talking to him and making jokes with exceptional friendliness. Yevgeny Pavlovich was behaving more sedately than usual, also perhaps from respect to the dignitaries. He was already well known in society, however. He was quite at home there, though he was so young. He arrived at the Epanchins that evening with crepe on his hat, and Princess Bielokonski remarked with approbation on it. Some fashionable young men would not under such circumstances have put on mourning for such an uncle. Lizaveta Prokofievna, too, was pleased at it, though she seemed on the whole preoccupied. Mushkin noticed that Aglaya looked at him intently once or twice, and he fancied she was satisfied with him. By degrees he began to feel very happy. His recent fantastical ideas and apprehensions after his conversation with Lebediev seemed to him now, when he suddenly at frequent intervals recalled them,
an inconceivable, incredible, even ridiculous dream. His chief, though unconscious impulse and desire, had been all day to do something to make him disbelieve that dream. He spoke little, and only in answer to questions, and finally was silent altogether. He sat still and listened, but was evidently enjoying himself extremely. By degrees, something like an inspiration was beginning to work within him too, ready to break out at the first opportunity. He began talking, indeed by chance in answer to questions, and apparently quite without any special design.